So I'm Patty Cushing. I am a director of examinations in NFA's member oversight department. So as my title would lead you to believe, I oversee the examination staff who do our exams. And so we're going to focus today on the exam process and common findings that we find. Gay Pellucci is a senior manager of examinations, and Tyler Kovach is a manager of examinations. So lots of exams here. We're going to welcome your questions throughout this hour-long panel so that we're more interactive and getting you what you need. So please feel free to jump in with your questions, and we'll get the roving microphone to you so that you can ask and everyone can hear. So the examination process, we ready to kick us off? Yeah, Tyler, go ahead.
Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Tyler Kovach. I'm a manager of examinations in the member oversight department. So I'm sure many of you here are interested to know just how you got so lucky with getting a visit from the NFA for an exam, or maybe you're just a new member who's curious about the process. Do you want to go to the next slide?
Absolutely.
So NFA has a risk management group that is responsible for formulating our exam schedule based on quantitative models that consider a number of factors, including but not limited to those that are listed here. After weighing all that information, a risk score is assigned, which helps with triaging exams based on priorities. Then exams are assigned out to exam teams. Exam teams consider these preliminary risks that are flagged by RMG while planning exams and formulating our scopes of testing. Some member registration categories like FCMs and swap dealers that have higher capital risk are lucky enough to be visited nearly once a year, regardless of the risks that are associated. So, after a member firm is selected for an exam, the assigned exam team will formally announce the exam over the phone and via email. Generally, exam teams include time frames in which the team is planning to visit on site and may include some preliminary requests to get familiar with the firm. These requests include a firm exam questionnaire that firm personnel fill out related to general information, detailed pool and CTA program information, key personnel, revenues, customer information, and vendors. CPO and FCM exams also receive internal control questionnaires that request specific information about control processes that may be in place related to investment decisions, valuations, money movements, and administrators. There may also be additional requests for written supervisory procedures, org charts, firm or pool financials, trade blotters, customer complaint files. The team will hold an operations call with the firm generally after receiving back those initial documents to discuss the firm's operations at a high level and any responses the firm provided that may need additional clarification. Once the exam planning is finalized, an initial document request list is sent to the firm requesting documents and responses related to the scopes of our testing. Documentation for this can be provided via RFS, which is a secure filing system for deadline tracking and file organizational purposes, which helps both the exam team and you as a member firm.
And Tyler, I forgot to ask when we started, who here has already been through an NFA examination? Well, lucky you. And you're here to keep us honest then. So if things we say seem different, please, you know, let us know and talk to us about that, and we can kind of reconcile. Thanks.
So now that the exam started, what does it look like? During the first few weeks, there'll be a number of meetings with key personnel to discuss different firm processes or clarify request responses virtually via Teams as we analyze the information that you provided. There will also be an on-site portion of the exam where we will spend a period of time in the firm's offices and conduct meetings or walkthroughs of different processes with firm personnel. Fieldwork is also a great chance to have clarifying discussions related to previous conversations held, discuss documents provided in more detail, and walk through those processes that assist in effectively completing our testing. Throughout the exam team will do their best to convey any findings related to those areas of testing so that corrective action can be implemented as soon as possible. The use of Microsoft Teams as the exam progresses also allows us to send Outlook meeting invites to the proper people, video chat together, and screen share to walk through documentation. Firms can also expect to hear from us via email near weekly during an ongoing exam related to scheduling meetings, sending document request lists, clarifying items, and conveying exam findings.
And Tyler, I am going to jump in because this slide talks about on-site field work. And here in London, we don't get the opportunity to come here as often for various reasons. And so we may do your exam completely virtually. So just keep that in mind that you might not have us at your office.
After the early pre-exam phase and the ongoing exam, eventually all great NFA exams have to come to an end. As the exam team finalizes their testing and exam work is being reviewed by exam supervisors and managers, an exit interview is ultimately scheduled with the firm. On the exit, the exam team will discuss the exam report with firm personnel prior to official issuance. This will include exam findings, any associated rule violations, and any corrective action that may be needed or still remains outstanding. An exam report will subsequently be issued that outlines NFA's testing period, exam findings, and associated rule violations. It will also outline the time frame in which the firm must respond to each exam finding. Within the response, firms should outline why the deficiency occurred and any corrective action already taken and any updates to firm processes or internal controls. The exam reports are confidential information that will only be shared with the firm and appropriate regulatory agencies.
Let's pause for questions. Anybody have questions on the process of our exams, how we select? Yes. If you could wait for the microphone, please.
You said that for London firms, you don't get the opportunity to see them in person as much. So if a firm were to have an in-person visit, would that be a red flag?
Not necessarily a red flag. It just could be the complexity of your operations are a bit more. Maybe it's your first exam. If we had done a prior exam and had limited findings, we might not necessarily have to come back here to do the other one. So it's not necessarily a red flag. And you can ask your exam leader, are you coming? Are you not coming? What's the reasons for you not coming or coming? And they will tell you point blank what it is. It's usually complexity.
I had a question with regards to the length of time that the exams take. How long, particularly virtual versus on-site, is there a standard length of time that these take? Or is it like a week, 2 weeks, a month? And how much time do we normally expect?
So there is not a standard time. Again, it all depends on the complexity of your operations and what areas of testing we have to do. So it is definitely a conversation to have with your lead examiner as to what they think. When we are on site, it's typically 2 weeks or less actually in the field, but the follow-up questions and the interaction and the teams meetings that we'll set up will linger for that. And it's months before an exam is finished. But again, your lead examiner can tell you exactly what they're thinking. And it's usually an ebb and flow as well. Things are fast and furious during the pre-exam process and what we would consider the field work phase. But then the document, staff need to take time to document things. They go through a review process. And so then you'll get a flurry once their supervisor has reviewed things and they have more questions. So it's an ebb and flow, but at any point in time, just talk to your lead examiner about what they think and how it's going and any concerns you have with it.
Yeah, I think I would just add one thing in regards to the field work length. We are appreciative and understand, there's a lot of remote working environments now. So we take that into consideration when we schedule field work. If there are individuals that we would like to meet with, who are not in the main office location or located in a branch office or an exempt remote location, we'll factor that in. We might not need to be on site as long if we're not having contact with the personnel that we need. So we'll have those meetings virtually.
Hi. Could you detail the sources of information for the factors that feed in the risk assessment model? Are these public information? Are these observations from filings?
Do you want to handle that? The RMG slides.
All right. So I put the slide up again. And there is, it's pretty much all the information that NFA has regarding you, from your registration records to your disclosure documents to the financial filings that you file. If any customers complain, that is part of the assessment. So it's pretty much taking all of that and just lining you up with the other 3,000 members that we're looking at to figure out who to see next. And one thing that is heavily weighted is prior exam findings. So that's the very first thing you should always do, is grab your last report and make sure that you have everything corrected there. There's repeat findings are a concern, and they're common, and so that's why it is fed into our system so much.
And just building off the last one, just interested to know the extent to which you discuss with the local regulators. So in the UK, the FCA, we're interested to see in our last report that it was circulated, copied to the FCA. So interested in the extent to which, you know, that goes into your risk factor sort of calculation.
Yeah, I can start here. Our risk department, you know, once we do identify that we're going to have UK-regulated firms on the exam schedule, you know, there is communication with foreign regulators to let them know we are going to be conducting the exams. As a courtesy at times, you know, we do let them know some of the meetings that we are having with the firm. And, you know, if there's any overlap there, you know, they're welcome to join and be part of those meetings or virtual meetings or on-site meetings. And then when we do issue the exam report, it is typical standard that we will share that with a regulator like the FCA, just so they're aware of our findings. And then there can be discussions as far as any ongoing monitoring that needs to be conducted.
I was going to ask if there is a process to deal with the aftermath of an exam. You walked us through what an exam is, but what happens after, if you can share anything?
Sure. So afterwards, Tyler mentioned that we do want the firms to provide corrective action for any findings that we have had. Hopefully that's done, you know, when we have a finding, we bring it to your attention right away so that you can, you know, we all just want to be in compliance. So you can put in corrective action right away and demonstrate that then. There will be a request for a response to the exam report, which you can hopefully say we already put in this corrective action that we discussed with your team. A lot of times it's updating procedures, it's explaining what in your process you changed to help avoid the same violation in the future. So really that's kind of the ending of the exam process. If there are material findings in your exam report, first of all, it will say that we find these to be very serious violations. At that point, there could be a discussion at the senior management level as to whether or not we need to take further action against the firm. And that's, you know, a very big decision. And only 5% of our exams end up having that conversation. So the question is that the closure process?
Is there going to be a closure moment where we're both on the same page that...
Yeah, I mean, your lead examiner can probably tell you after they have everything if the exam is closed or not. But, you know, it's a long discussion if we need to go further. So it's not immediate, like, yes, it's done.
Sorry, while the mic's here, just a quick question. Is there a particular time frame post-launch of a particular firm that the NFA will consider examining, or is it purely based on a risk-based approach? I know some examiners have certain kind of criteria to say within a certain number of years firms will be examined. Is that the case with the NFA? Or?
So it's risk-based, for sure. But time since your registration without an exam is a factor that is considered, and time since the last exam is also a factor. So, but there's no set guidelines as to what.
A quick question for me. After the report is issued, you mentioned we need to respond as a firm to the corrective actions. Usually, how long is the time period that you expect to receive a response from the firm that remediation actions are complete?
We ask for the written response usually about 10 business days from the issuance of the report. If remediation is going to take longer than that, again, we probably told you about the deficiency early on in the process, so you might have had all this time to do it. But if it's a late blooming issue that we bring to your attention and you need more time, you just need to tell us what your plan is to get to that. And then, again, the lead examiner can work with you on when you demonstrate remediation.
We appreciated all those questions. Very well thought out. And great job, Tyler, walking through the exam process. Very good information there and, you know, practical guidance that everyone can use going forward to prepare for our exams. So now at this point, we wanted to transition to discussing common exam findings that we routinely see during our examinations of commodity pool operators, commodity trading advisors, FCMs, and FDMs. So I think a good starting point for us was to share with you a pretty comprehensive listing of procedures commonly reviewed during these exam processes. Like I said, it's a pretty lengthy list. Some of these will be covered in slides that I'm going to be discussing, that Patty's going to be discussing. We also have a few additional panels today that are dedicated to some of these topics that are going to provide you a really deeper dive. So I'll kind of just highlight those. Maybe you can jot down some questions that you have about those and save them for later slides or panels. But again, I'll just run through these quickly, give you a high-level overview of what, at a minimum basis, these procedures should contain. One note, some of these procedures are applicable to all types of registration categories, are applicable to a certain segment of registration category based on those activities. And so based on that, it'll really depend on if these procedures are reviewed during your examination or not. So just working through these, the first one is cybersecurity, ISSP. Again, these are going to be policies and procedures to oversee your cybersecurity activities, including training of your employees and also annual reviews of the program. Tyler and Michelle are going to be leading a discussion on cybersecurity, so definitely save questions for them. They're going to have a lot of information at their disposal to share with you. Next is promotion material. Patty's going to jump into this in a little more detail as we go. But again, these procedures are going to be created and implemented to oversee the creation and use of the promotion material, really at a high level to ensure that this material is not misleading in nature and is in line with your current activities. Broker communications, we're going to do a deep dive into this, Corey and myself, later on in the afternoon during the supervision panel. So really talk about the requirements around the record retention of broker communications and the ultimate supervision and monitoring of these records. Registration of APs and bylaw 1101 and supervision of branch offices. These are topics that I'm going to get into following this slide. So again, these are just general registration requirements that we require of all of our member firms. The business continuity plan, this is a plan that needs to be created and implemented in order to ensure that you can continue operations if in the event that your main office location is inaccessible, that you have a backup location where you can continue servicing your customers for, have procedures in place to ensure that, they're being serviced on a daily basis in the event of an emergency. Customer complaints, very important to have documented procedures for this area. These procedures allow your employees to be aware of the process, to be able to receive customer complaints, document them accordingly, implement an escalation process for the investigative work that needs to be conducted for customer complaints, any remediation and disciplinary action that needs to be taken as a result of a customer complaint. Third-party service providers, I'm going to talk about this in further detail in the next slide, so I'll kind of just skim over that one. Next up is internal controls. This is typically in relation to our FCN, FDM, IBs, and CPO members. So for FCMs and IBs, these internal controls typically oversee the creation of financial records, you know, the maintenance of your general ledger, your balance sheets, the creation of your net capital computation, segregation of duties in relation to your financial activities on a day-to-day basis. For CPO registrants, you know, these internal controls talk about and oversee the day-to-day operations and supervision of your commodity pools. Order placement, you know, these procedures are applicable to all registration categories that execute orders on behalf of their customers or any trading vehicles or separately managed accounts that you operate. Trade activity, transfers, and error account activities, these procedures would be applicable to any registration category that has proprietary accounts, you know, whether they be for proprietary trading or error activity. You know, these procedures are going to ensure that you're overseeing and monitoring activity in those accounts to ensure they're being used what they're meant to be used for, and there's not any concerning activity being conducted in those accounts. Ethics training, these are procedures that you're going to create to ensure that your APs are adequately trained on ethics training. You know, we're going to touch on this a little later as far as what the actual requirements are. And then lastly here, from a procedural perspective, is anti-money laundering. You should have a very comprehensive AML program in place if you're an FCM, FDM, or IB. You know, these procedures should oversee all of your anti-money laundering activities, inclusive of the training of your employees that are susceptible to anti-money laundering and ensuring that an annual independent audit is conducted of the program. So just the last point here before we move on is, you know, our risk analysis, what kind of Tyler hit on before, in that pre-planning process really drives our scope of testing. So like I said, you know, some of these procedures might be applicable to your registration category and activities, but, you know, it doesn't guarantee that we will review them during the examination process. You know, if we do our pre-planning process and determine there are certain low-risk areas, we might not dedicate resources to that area and focus somewhere else. So again, it doesn't guarantee that all of these procedures will be reviewed. Okay. So we wanted to spend a little more time on a somewhat newer requirement, not yesterday, but, you know, since September of 2021, Interpretive Notice 9079 requires member firms to oversee and supervise third parties performing regulatory functions on the member firm's behalf. So we wanted to spend a little time, you know, to provide reminders of the minimum requirements of the Interpretive Notice. And what your written supervisory procedures around the monitoring and supervision of these third parties should include. So to start, it should include an initial risk assessment. So prior to establishing the relationship with that third party, you should conduct a very comprehensive risk analysis of that third party. You know, it can even assign a risk rating, low, medium, high, based on the services that they're going to be performing on your behalf. And that risk rating will kind of drive that relationship going forward. The next item that you're going to be required to implement into your procedures is onboarding due diligence, including executing a written agreement. So again, this should occur prior to establishing the relationships. You should really conduct a comprehensive due diligence to ensure that this third party is one fit, capable, knowledgeable, has the experience to perform this regulatory function on your behalf. Once it's decided that it's an appropriate relationship to establish, you should execute a written agreement outlining the expectations from both parties in the relationship and what that third party is going to be providing you from a regulatory function. The next one is extremely important. We do require that you perform ongoing monitoring of these third-party service providers. Again, going back to your initial risk assessment, you can determine what that frequency, what that scope of review should look like. You know, we do understand our member firms have relationships with very well-established, knowledgeable, experienced third-party service providers within the financial services industry. You know, for those relationships, it might be appropriate to do a less frequent review, a less comprehensive review versus if you're using maybe a startup third party that has limited knowledge, has limited experience, a more frequent review might be appropriate there. So really, again, once you do that initial risk assessment, that's going to kind of drive your frequency and scope of ongoing monitoring. Another very important procedure to have in place is the termination. So this is going to oversee and manage the termination of these relationships. So once it is decided that a third party is no longer servicing the firm, it really needs to be procedures in place to ensure that termination or that relationship is, you know, completely severed. All access to your system should be revoked. All access to any financial statements that that third party had should be revoked, really to ensure that that third party can no longer pose a risk to you as soon as that relationship is ended.
Can I jump in here? And records, if they maintained records on your behalf, you need to, part of the termination needs to be, how are you getting those records in-house now to be able to maintain them and demonstrate that you have them? So frequently we find that a member has terminated their relationship with their third party, maybe it was their administrator, and all the books and records for the pool were at the administrator, and either the admin goes out of business or something of that nature, or there's bad feelings, and then you can't get your records. So you definitely, first of all, should be pulling them in-house every month anyway, but if not, the termination should have it set out how you're going to get your records.
Yeah, that's a great point, Patty. Thank you. And just a last reminder here, we want to make sure that you're documenting all of the activities in this process, right? You know, it's great to have policies and procedures in place, but if you can't substantiate that these activities are occurring to your regulator, you know, we're going to have concern that they're actually occurring. So again, ensuring, you know, once you do that, you know, initial risk assessment, it's documented in writing where we can come in and say, okay, you know, this third party was identified to be a low risk third-party service provider, and, you know, therefore doing an annual review is appropriate. So again, having that rationale on how you got to that decision, how you assign that risk rating, ongoing monitoring, right, to have actual reports, have a file to be able to substantiate that you are doing these reviews, again, really gives us the comfort that, you know, this procedure is being implemented in accordance with what you've created.
So let's pause for questions on this, because it is a new requirement, newer requirement, and is one of our common deficiencies. So,
fantastic. Most people don't complain about never hearing me anyways. This has come up in some industry forums before around third-party service providers, and it depends on which area we're talking about, because, say, for instance, market infrastructure tends not to really necessarily provide all the information that if a procedure or policy set out a group standard doesn't necessarily meet a group standard, going back to what you were saying about perhaps startups, etc. So the amount of information that we would actually have access to does tend to vary. So when it comes then to examinations, that variance in information has sometimes led to further questions amongst other industry participants, and I'm just wondering kind of how the NFA is balancing that as part of their examination cycle.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you have limited information on a third-party service provider, you know, we're going to look that you did the best of your ability to obtain enough information for you to make an informed decision if they're appropriate or not. Again, you know, just I don't want to name names here, but, you know, there are very large institutions that provide services that are very close to their guard. They're not going to share a lot of information with you. They're just going to rely on a lot of name reputation. So again, you know, we're just ensuring you do the best of your ability to get to a comfort level that that third party is appropriate to perform that regulatory function.
And I would say the ongoing monitoring is where you will maybe put in extra steps to mitigate the fact that you didn't have all the information up front. And so maybe you have extra checks and balances in the information that you're relying on or the things that they're doing for you.
Yeah, and you know, some of the bigger firms obviously have publicly available information. You know, you can certainly rely on that. But again, it's just, we're going to get to a comfort level if you're doing the best of your ability to get to that comfort level.
One of the things we spent a lot of time on in the last exam was differentiating between who's a supplier versus a
supplier that fits into the category of the third-party service provider and how one defines what a third-party service provider is. I'd just be interested for some, perhaps some examples or some further guidance on that distinction.
You can start.
Okay, so it really is a regulatory function that you as a member firm have to do if you have a third party doing that for you. That falls under this. Not to say that you ignore all vendors and suppliers. I mean, you should still do whatever you think you need to do, but the rule applies to someone like that. So what kind of registration category are you? Introducing broker. Okay, I'll let you name some common third-party services.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Patty, and I think another distinction that should be made is that, you know, it's a service that you're not able to perform on your own, right? So, like, you can't perform an independent audit of your financial statement. And so, you know, we wouldn't agree that a CPA would fall under this.
Yeah, CPA doesn't fall under this. You're still going to do due diligence on your CPA, right? But it doesn't meet this. So it would be somebody, a bookkeeper, who files your net capital computation on your behalf.
So for an introducing broker, if you're providing broker services to your customer and you have 135 requirements and you're creating records of verbal and chat or written communications, if you don't house them internally on your servers and you have somebody do that for you, again, that is someone that you're deciding to perform that service on your behalf. So someone like that would be fall under this interpretive notice.
CPOs, without a doubt, your administrator falls under this. That's the largest. Somebody maybe that you hire to file your PQRs on your behalf would fall under this rule. CTA, somebody who puts together your, again, your quarterly reports, your PRs, that would be a provider. So someone who's doing it, something that you are required to do.
And just to add quickly, so we've been seeing more and more that members have been relying on affiliates to perform certain functions, including supervision of, say, broker communications and trading activity at the IB level. This is an area, too, where it is important if there are specific legal entities where there's a difference there that those relationships are also supervised. Obviously, an affiliate is probably somebody that you work very closely with, so drafting a policy and procedure that covers, you know, maybe a little bit more of a low-risk area there, but still ensuring that those reviews are being done or that those records are being kept or those financials are being completed on behalf of the other affiliate is very important.
Yeah, question here, maybe a little bit wider than third-party providers. How do you see substituted compliance in all of this? Because obviously there are rules to follow and then there are substituted compliance. How does it kind of interact?
So substitute compliance, you know, if there is in the CFTC regulations things that say, you know, whatever is allowed by this regulator is acceptable to us, then that's fine. That's substitute compliance. And we might test to see, we're not really going to test for your compliance with the other regulators' rules, but we are going to look at perhaps the reports and things from those other regulators. If they have concerns in that area, we'll see if they are concerning to us as well. So I would say that's really how it works, is if the CFTC says you can rely on the other regulator, then that's what you're doing.
Okay, great. Just one more slide here on some of the procedures that we just outlined for you. So we wanted to spend some time on another area that we do see common findings. This is around the registration requirements of our member firms. So the first one is in regards to associated persons. You know, these are any individuals that are meeting the definition of an associated person through any solicitation, marketing, brokerage service activities that require AP registration. And another reminder that we wanted to, you know, provide you guys here is because it's something that we do see a lot that falls through the cracks is not performing a thorough analysis of the supervisory chain of command. You know, because individuals who supervise APs must also ultimately be registered as APs. So again, really performing that analysis to ensure that that whole supervisory chain of command is properly registered if need be. Branch offices is another area where we see registration failures. So again, just a reminder, the definition of a branch office is any location other than the main business address that employs one or more persons engaged in activities requiring registration as an AP. You know, subsequent to the COVID-19 pandemic and the move to remote working environments, there is a carve-out or exception to the definition of a branch office. You know, that's typically a remote location that has one or more related APs that are meeting certain criteria on a day-to-day basis. You know, they're not holding themselves out in the name of the firm at this location. They're not meeting with customers at this location. They're not holding customer funds at this location, and ultimately, you know, their business records are maintained and accessible at the main office location. So if you are operating any of these locations, they don't have to be listed with NFA, you know, as a branch office, but it should be still supervised, right? So any policies and procedures you have over the supervision of branch offices, you know, as a best practice, should also oversee these remote locations as well. And the last area we just wanted to touch on was Bylaw 1101. You know, obviously an extremely important rule for our members to be in compliance with. You know, this prohibits our members from doing business with individuals or entities that require registration but are not. You know, you should obviously be doing your Bylaw 1101 due diligence prior to establishing any relationships with your customers. But the important reminder here is, you know, things that we do see not being done in our exams is doing this periodically, you know, throughout these relationships. So you should be re-reviewing customers, clients, or pool participants that have claimed an exemption from registration, as these exemptions must be reaffirmed every year. So again, onboarding, Bylaw 1101 due diligence, and then periodic Bylaw 1101 due diligence as you manage that relationship. So again, before passing it along to Patty, we'll just solicit for any questions.
Thank you. Branch offices, are there any limits to the number of branch offices that you can have?
Not that I'm aware of. You know, they just need to be properly listed within our systems. They need to have a listed and registered branch office manager at each location. And they should all, you know, be under the established supervisory framework that you've implemented. So I'm not aware of any limits.
The only thing that can come into play is at introducing brokers and FCMs. The more branch offices you have, the more capital you might be required to have, but it's a pretty large number, so doesn't usually come into play.
Thank you. And then just a question on the supervision of APs. So under the SMCR regime, we have MCERTs who look after, say, a desk of eight individuals because that's a desk manager, but they might be three or four desks in a derivative division. There will be someone who oversees that derivative division. Should the supervisor be sort of similar at an MCERT level, or would you be looking for it to be the person who oversees the whole derivatives division?
I would say generally, and we're going to have a supervision panel that, you know, kind of dives into this a little more. I would say generally we would expect anyone in that chain of command. So if it's a desk head overseeing that specific area, then they should be registered as an AP, and then ultimately any individual that that desk manager reports into and has supervisory authority over them should also be registered.
Thank you.
Good morning. Just two questions, please. First one is that we have a regulatory conflict. I'm based in Jersey in the Channel Islands, around registered office for records and place of work for records under NFA supervision. So we've got a regulatory conflict there that hasn't been from a recent examination. So we're just wondering how we get over that conflict. And you're talking about substitute compliance. So that's the first thing there.
Why don't we talk about that one-on-one afterwards, and okay, we'll get into the specifics for you.
I've got an even more technical question around branch offices and arbitrage between actually having a physical company that's a branch office in the UK vis-a-vis the Channel Islands. So perhaps I'll catch up with you.
Yeah. That's going to be like
pretty
it.
Deep too.
Okay. Right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right. We're going to move on to promotional material. This is NFA's rules apply to all registration categories that we're talking about this morning when it comes to promotion material. And how you get your customers in the door is of importance to us. And so we do usually make this a focus on our examinations. And so as a result, it comes here to the workshop under common exam findings of the things that we tend to have to comment on. The first thing is that our rules do require that you have a balanced presentation. When you talk about the possibility for profits, that you also do equally discuss the risk of loss that exists in what you are trading. And so it is not, you know, we added up one mention of loss means one mention of profit. It's not like that. It's just a balanced presentation when you're talking about profits, that in that conversation, you're also talking about the risks related to the trading program. There are several specific disclaimers that are required depending on what you present. If you are presenting past actual performance, then there is a past performance disclaimer. If it's hypothetical performance, there's a hypothetical disclaimer. If you are talking about Forex, there are specific things you should mention. So just, you know, depending on what the product is that you are promoting, please look at the rule to be sure you understand which disclaimers need to be there. When you make statements of fact, first of all, I would avoid things like superlatives. We are the largest, the fastest, the greatest. How are you going to support that? So most things, if it's a statement of fact, you are able to support that. And we will, if we think it is material, something that will sway a customer to open with you, then we will ask for supporting documentation. Hypothetical performance. This is, you know, there's lots of rules around this. Many of our CPOs and CTAs are 4.7, and so you do get a little bit more relief from the specific requirements. For example, if you're not 4.7, you can only show hypothetical results for 3 months. Until you have 3 months of actual performance, and then you can no longer show that. 4.7, there's more leeway, but you need to make it clear what is hypothetical versus what is actual. And then disclose material assumptions on how you got to those rates of return. For example, what was the minimum account size that you used? What fee structure did you implement? And of course, as I mentioned earlier, there's a hypothetical disclaimer that is required verbatim to be close to where you have the hypothetical results. Here's some trends that we're seeing in our promotion material now. There's a big trend with social media influencers, which apparently are called finfluencers. I don't know these things, but and we are seeing a trend of that. Just be careful of the interpretive notices that NFA does have regarding relying on links to third parties. You know, that you may start becoming responsible for whatever they are saying about your firm. Just, you know, we're not going to be like take 229 and make sure every single thing is accurate. But certainly if they are saying something outlandish about your firm, you know, you have procedures in place on how you're going to handle that. Referral programs, we are seeing an uptick in those, which is anything from having our customers refer people and giving them a break on commissions and other things like that. Just be careful that they don't become solicitors for you. So make sure that you have good procedures in place regarding that. This we talk about quite a bit, you know. It was Twitter, it's now X, right? Microblogging sites are out there. If you are putting something out there, like your rates of return, well, then you're also going to have to put past performance is not necessarily indicative of future results, and that's hard to do, right? So what we've seen more frequently is maybe a tweet that says, hey, our performance figures are available, check our website, you know, September's figures are out. That way, when you go to the website, you can have everything that's required by the rules there. And claims regarding the interbank Forex market, if you are trading Forex, over-the-counter Forex products, be careful not to make it seem like you are actually part of the interbank Forex market. That is a huge trillion-dollar industry and not necessarily what our OTC retail Forex is about. So we're seeing trends there as well. Any questions on promotional material before I move on? Back here, Matthew.
Thank you. The definition of promotional material has specific reference to commodities. However, would you say that the overall requirements apply to whatever asset that a participant may be dealing with?
I would say that avoiding misleading statements and being able to support things like that applies across the board. I would say perhaps the, you know, rates of return and specific disclaimers might not apply unless it's specifically to futures.
Thank
or
you.
Swaps or commodity interest.
Yes, I have two questions. The first one is, would you make a difference between a referral program and a contract with a business introducer? And the second question is, would you comment on any videos in terms of marketing material?
Okay, so the first question, if you have contracted with an entity, presumably that entity, if they are actually soliciting, is properly registered. So that's the first thing. And that's really the most important when it comes to that. The second thing was videos. So videos that are publicly available on your website, those are considered promotion material, and the rules do apply overall. If you mention a specific trade recommendation or past performance, then that is something that requires pre-filing with NFA and does need to go through a process. And if it's something that is updated, you know, hourly, daily, on a very frequent basis, you can often get the kind of the format reviewed, and my specialists don't like me to use the word approved, but accepted by NFA, and then give them the video after the fact for review. So that's a process that you can do too. All right, moving on to CPO and CTA disclosures. Let me check time. Two areas that are most commonly commented on by our examiners is just the performance calculations themselves not being done appropriately. Remember that when you are putting out your performance for your program, it should be reflective of, it should include all of the clients that are in that program. So you can't cherry pick and only pick a couple. There's rules in place on when you can exclude clients or not, but for the most part, it's 100% of your clients for the past 5 years. The other thing is all rates of return do need to be net of fees when you are presenting them. This, thankfully, is not a common deficiency, but it is infrequently enough implemented that we want to remind you of NFA Compliance Rule 251 or 250, which is our notice filing requirement that CPOs have to make a filing with NFA if one of these big events happens. If the pool cannot meet its margin calls, if you're unable to satisfy redemption requests in accordance with your subscription agreements, if you have halted redemptions contrary to situations that are outlined in your disclosure documents, such as you know, gates and lockups. But if you halt for any other reason, you need to notify us. And if the CPO receives notice from a swap counterparty that a pool it operates is in default. So those are obviously large events that happen, but you do, while you're dealing with that event, you also need to shoot off a notice to us to let us know that it has happened, and we are usually going to follow up and ask, you know, what brought this on and what disclosure have you provided to your investors, what sort of notices you've given them. Many of our pools and CTAs take advantage of exemptions. And I would say the things that you need to be sure you are maintaining are the documents to demonstrate that you are meeting the criteria of your exemption. So if you're 4-7 or a 413A3 pool who has qualified eligible persons as your clients or participants, you do need to have the records to demonstrate that they meet that criteria. And this is just the client's representation to you that they have it. We're not suggesting you have to start getting balance sheets and things like that. You can't ignore red flags, obviously, if somebody says they're a QEP, but they can't come up with your $10,000 minimum investment, then maybe they're not being truthful. That would be a red flag to look into a little bit closer. But basically, you just have them represent to you how they meet the definition of a QEP. And 413A3 does have trading restrictions with respect to it. You are going to keep your trading of commodity interests below certain tests. So being able to demonstrate that you are monitoring that is something that we often comment on. And finally, for CPOs, we're going to talk about pool financial reporting. Again, if you've ever been to our workshop before, I talk about this every time. So just going to bring it to your attention again that the pool account statements, the CFTC regulations are very specific as to what needs to be included in a pool account statement, and that it needs to be for the pool in its entirety, as well as if you are divided up in classes for the specific class that is being provided. So that needs to be there. It needs to be distributed within 30 days of the period end. If you are a fund of funds and you are 4-7 exempt, you have 45 days after the period end to get it distributed. And then the last thing is the oath and affirmation. This is signed by your somebody who is duly authorized to bind the pool operator. And again, the regulation is very specific. You know, it's true and accurate to the best of our knowledge. And it does have to have these items specifically stated below the signature. So that's CPOs and CTAs. All right, we'll move on to IBs.
So we, at this point, wanted to transition to start discussing the financial requirements for FCMs, FDMs, and IBs. You know, these are findings that we identified during NFA exam of these registration categories, specifically when we do our financial analysis of financial records, such as balance sheets, net capital computations, and all the underlying support for these records. So we just wanted to outline for you a few of the instances and times where we've had to propose adjusting journal entries to the firm's financial records, you know, which ultimately impact the firm's adjusted net capital and could threaten them not meeting their minimum net capital requirements. So again, this is not all inclusive. You know, these are just some of the common journal entries that we are making during the exams. So a lot of it revolves around the classification of assets, current versus non-current. Some examples we're seeing of this is secured receivables from affiliates. So guidance does allow, and CFTC rules does allow, for secured receivables from an affiliate to be a current asset. However, any unsecured receivables from the affiliate should always be classified as a non-current asset. Moving on, We do see issues with commissions receivable from FCMs, more typically in relation to, the aging of these receivables, if they're, greater than 30 days and not in line with the firm's normal operating or operations. We also have issues with aging receivables from non-customers. Specifically, if you're, for example, an introducing broker that is brokering, block futures options or certain swap products and have receivables directly from customers, ensuring that they're aged properly. We have seen issues with prepaid assets being reported as current assets. So again, just ensuring that these classifications are in accordance with GAAP and, the generally accepted accounting principles. From a liability perspective, we have seen firms not accurately reporting liabilities on a month-end reporting basis. Again, just ensuring that, your accounting principles are in accordance with GAAP and all liabilities are properly accrued for. And then lastly, we do see issues with firm inadequately taking charges and haircuts on certain investments the firm might be invested in at month end or even intra-month. You should be monitoring these investments on a day-to-day basis to ensure that you're taking those proper charges and haircuts on them. Also for foreign currency holdings, anything that is not denominated in USD and it is foreign to your operations should have the charge or haircut taken against it. So just as a resource, like for example, the 1FR guide is a great resource for introducing brokers to use, when preparing your financial records. It has great guidance in there as far as what should be current versus non-current. Any questions about financial requirements before we wrap up? Okay, perfect. So the last couple items we wanted to talk about are, common overdue items that we see throughout our exam process. And, some of these could be specific to certain registration categories, and some are specific to all registration categories. And just for clarification purposes, when we do say annual, we're generally meaning on a calendar year basis. So we do expect all of these requirements to be done once per calendar year. So the first is cybersecurity training. The interpretive notice does require that cybersecurity training be provided upon hire or onboarding of an employee. We do recommend this be done as soon as possible. This is to mitigate any risk of this employee gaining access to your systems and not being aware of threats posed, right? So training them as soon as possible is always a best practice. And then you're also required to provide annual cybersecurity training to your employees. The interpretive notice around cybersecurity also requires an annual review of your ISSP, ensuring that this is being performed by a qualified person and being done on an annual basis. Ethics training, the interpretive notice around ethics training does allow you as a member firm to deem what's reasonable as far as a periodic time frame to complete ethics training. Your procedure should also include the topics that your APs are going to be trained on. So again, once you determine that frequency that's appropriate for your activities, ensuring your APs are held to that standard. Annual AML training and annual independent AML audits, something we touched on earlier, ensuring that all employees that are susceptible to anti-money laundering are trained on an annual basis, and then ensuring that an independent individual or entity that is separate from your AML activities is conducting a review of the program on an annual basis. The two important things here, like with all of these requirements, we really want to make sure that all of these activities are documented accordingly, right? Maintaining training certificates, maintaining the independent report that was issued to the firm from the AML auditor, maintaining evidence of any remediation of weaknesses that were identified. So really ensuring that there's an audit trail for all of this activity. Annual branch office audits, making sure that, all remote or listed branch offices with NFA are annually reviewed. There is some relief where, certain branch offices can be remotely inspected every other year. You know, if you do deem that a remote inspection is appropriate, you know, making sure you're documenting the rationale as to why you've come to that conclusion, and then also maintaining any branch office audit reports that are issued. Financial statement filings, just in my opinion, and I think Patty touched on this before, you know, probably the most important one here, right? You know, this information is super important for us to kind of drive our risk assessment of firms, you know, making sure that you have an internal control and process in place that allows you to submit all of your filings on a timely basis. NFA has taken action against member firms solely on the basis that they've habitually filed statements late. So it's extremely important, like I said, that you have controls and processes in place in order to meet your filing requirements. And the last one, self-exam checklist. Again, you know, we have a minimum requirement of an annual basis for this. You know, but we recommend you're doing this as frequent as you need. You know, this is a great resource and tool for you to, you know, kind of perform some self-regulation on yourself. You know, if you ever go through any material changes in your operations, you know, you maybe launch a new business line, you bring on a new trading desk through an acquisition. Great opportunity to recomplete that self-exam checklist to make sure you have all your P's and Q's in place and making sure that new business line is going to be compliant, you know, when it comes on board. So again, we'll be looking for this at a minimum to be done annually, but, you know, use it as an ongoing resource. It's a great tool. NFA's website is updated whenever there's a new version of the self-exam checklist. So, you know, hop on the website, download the most current version, and use it as a tool going forward.
And Tyler's going to bring us home with the importance of that self-exam checklist/questionnaire.
Yep. So we'll talk about how to avoid common deficiencies. And again, the NFA self-exam questionnaire is a really important tool to be used by our member firms. Although, like Gabe said, the NFA self-exam questionnaire is required to be completed at least annually, the firm can still use this at any time throughout the year to assist with its compliance obligations or just as reminders throughout the year. So think of the NFA self-exam questionnaire as a mini exam. It outlines different areas of testing and contains questioning related to certain processes or requirements that fall under various rules or regulations that the firm needs to have in place in event it fits their operations or registration category. I want to emphasize the fact that the self-exam also includes items related to many of NFA's interpretive notices that are out there, so it's a good guide as to what exam teams may look for while performing exams as required practices or processes. This is available directly on NFA's website. Simply search self-exam in the search bar or find it under the members page.
Thank you, gentlemen. Very nicely done. And any last questions for us?
You mentioned before when you were talking about the branch office audit that this could be done virtually every other year. Is that a requirement or is it based on... Okay.
No, it's just relief that's offered to our member firms that have branch offices. You know, if... And it's really risk-based. You know, if, say, a branch office has very limited activity, you know, it could be deemed appropriate to do remote inspection every other year, but that other year has to be on-site.
So the expectation is that there will periodically be on-site?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Hi. Thanks. I know this morning was mainly on CPOs, CTAs, IBs, and so on, so but the self-examination questionnaire, for swap dealers as well, is there a similar one that exists, or is this specifically just for these guys?
There is not a similar one. My swap dealer people right here are telling me that. So I'm sure this afternoon they're going to give you some tips, though, on how to avoid common deficiencies.
Hi, sorry. I missed my slot with the CPOs earlier. But regarding the qualification in terms of client categorizations, you mentioned kind of verifying the status in terms of QEPs, professional categorizations, but then you obviously said we don't need to actually ask for balance sheets, etc. So as part of the subscription documents, obviously they're verifying and they're ticking the appropriate box. Is that enough, or do we need to kind of go in a little bit deeper?
You know, again, you can't ignore red flags if you think that they're not answering it truthfully, but you can just have... They can indicate how it is that they meet the QEP definition. We frown upon, you know, I am a QEP check because nobody knows what that is, right? But outlining the various ways you could be a QEP and having them initial which one applies to them.